Our readings this morning proclaim the love and the competency of God. All of them, the Old Testament, the Psalm, the Epistle, the Gospel, they all proclaim the love and competency of God. But they proclaim that within a context, and the context is up and down and good and bad and all over the place, and those contexts produce, in most of us anyway, worry. I think I've told you before that when I was a very little boy, my mom's nickname for me was, Todd, you're nothing but a worrywart. And I found out that a worrywart is not like the kind of thing you can brush medicine on and that it goes away, that somehow worry is very deep in our hearts, our thoughts, in our feelings. It's not the kind of thing you can just brush a little medicine on. In fact, I've found over the years that if I have a moment where I have nothing to worry about, I figure I must have forgotten something that I should be worrying about. I mean, maybe some of you can relate. I can't be the only worrywart in this room. But I have to say, I came by it honestly. I always say I'm from Santa Ana, but technically I was born at St. Joseph's in Orange. Until I was 7, I lived in Garden Grove, but I spent most of my life in Santa Ana, so I always say I'm from Santa Ana. But if you can picture kind of like old Garden Grove where, you know, after World War II, they started building these little, you know, three-bedroom, two-bath houses, and they had a little backyard. You know, it was kind of the beginning of suburbia. Well, I loved baseball. I mean, my mom has a picture of me 1 year old holding a baseball. I go figure. I don't know where I got it. It came to me naturally. And so I loved playing baseball in the backyard, and there was one rule. You cannot play with a hard ball in the backyard. But only sissies play with wiffle balls or tennis balls. I'm like, whatever. No, and so I would always sneak and play with the hard ball. And one day, of course, you know what happens? A hard ball goes flying through the dining room window. Crash, shatter everywhere. You know, it's probably 3:20 in the afternoon. My mother comes out. You know, I'm 54 years old, and I was probably 7 when this happened. I've never forgotten it. You go to your room. And what? Remember the note of the rest of the sentence? You wait till what? Your father gets home. I'm like, holy criminy, you know, it's like this big cosmic thing, you know. So you go to your room and you sit there. You see, fear has an object. You know, like if right now I said, look out, he's got a gun, you know, that's got a direct object, right? Fear is way more insidious. It kind of just sits in us in this vague but destroying kind of way. And so I sat in my room, you know. This was back in the day when dads used to hassle the I-5 for 15 minutes, you know, and they'd always be home by about 5:30. So I had about 2 hours to kill in my room. And then you know how it goes. You hear the car pull up in the driveway. Suddenly you're like a dog hearing sounds that no one else can hear, right? The rubber tires roll over the asphalt at that time, in those days, the asphalt driveway, and you can hear the little pebbles being sucked up into the, you know, the slots in the rubber, and then you hear the door open, and then you hear, right? Hear mom and dad talking, and then you hear the footsteps, you know, coming down the hallway. The door cracks open, and now all of a sudden your worry has a direct object. His dad is suddenly Indiana Jones, you know, he whips off his belt, you know, and says, I told you to play with that blankety blank wiffle ball in the backyard. So, for lots of us, I think worry is intuitive. Ann Landers, at the height of her career, said that she got 10,000 letters a week, and that by far the number one thing that her letters talked about was some form of anxiety or fear. Well, either we're all really stupid, or we're all really unspiritual, or think of it this way, there really are a lot of things to worry about. If you've got your smartphone open right now, just go to Google and press in, I don't know, AP News or something. And here's what you'll find. Political hatred spreading in America. Hundreds of people dying in an earthquake in New Zealand. People in this room or our families and friends are sick or broken. There's government shakeups in the Mideast. Our economy may never be the same. We don't know how we're going to pay for social programs a decade from now. Nobody knows what's going to happen to boomer retirement and old age. And you can mark my words that 5 or 10 years from now, one of the major suggestions for fixing the healthcare system will be euthanasia for boomers. It's coming. So that will be a serious suggestion, just mark my words, within the next 5 years or so. And then, of course, there's the really important things, the King's Speech or social network for Oscar. You know, it's. But when you think about that litany of things, life can begin to feel like Frankenstein or Jurassic Park, like it's some big divine experiment that's going horribly wrong and that it seems sort of out of control. Well, the word worry comes from an old Anglo-Saxon word, which means essentially to strangle or to choke. And that is of course, precisely what it does to life in general. I mean, it can do it to relationships, it can do it at work, but it certainly does it to our spiritual life. This is why the proverb says, an anxious heart weighs a person down. It makes us feel like this experiment is going radically out of control. We have no way of coping with it, so we feel out of control. Unless, of course, you're a bird or a flower, in which case God's got you covered. See, it's that life of a flower or a bird, this unworried, fully cared for life that Jesus in this passage is inviting us into. Now, we're going to refer to the other readings this morning, but I want us to focus a bit more on the gospel. You might want to get that gospel passage in front of you in your bulletin. Because there's a logic here. And the logic here is this. In this proclamation of God's utterly competent love, the logic is that God's greater gift of his kingdom, that is to say, bringing to earth his gracious, loving rule and reign, that greater gift always includes the lesser gift. The logic of this passage is that God is capable for doing for you what he does for flowers and birds, and what he did for Israel with manna. This is why the sort of kind of punchline is, seek first the kingdom of God. I'm still not sure I've really plumbed the depths of this, and it's always seemed a bit, I don't know, it gets my attention every time, where Jesus will pull a little child in front of him and say, this little child, they really get the kingdom. And you need to be like these little children. And I think this is very hard for us because we don't really value children all that much in our world. I mean, not that we devalue them, but we don't value them as spiritual guides. We certainly don't value them as having any sort of intellectual competence or competence about life. I mean, to be a child means the opposite, to not have any competence about life. So what can Jesus mean when he commends children and their attitudes and ways of life with reference to the kingdom? Well, I think it means something like this. Children have this very deep inner assurance that someone will care for them. They're just a bit like the birds and the flowers that way. And I think this is what Jesus is commending, that unless a child has had some sort of abuse in their life, you know, 99.9% of children, they just have this unquestioned thing that mom or dad or Uncle Joe or grandma or somebody's going to take care of me. And that has to be abused out of them. If it's not abused out of them, what is normative is someone cares for me. Now, when Jesus says, look at the flowers of the field, you know, they don't spin or toil, look at the birds of the air, you know, they don't seem to be worried. This passage does not mean that work is bad. It doesn't even mean that hard work is bad. It doesn't even mean that long periods of hard work are bad. I mean, I was up this morning sitting in the living room. Obviously, it's a beautiful day, looking outside, and there were birds everywhere. And they looked very busy to me. And they looked really intent on what they were doing, you know, whew, whew, you know, here and there. And they looked like they were pretty focused on what they were doing. So it's not that we should never work. What Jesus is saying is, those birds don't look worried, you know. You know, you don't see. You know, you don't see birds, you know, a little feather over their head. You know, oh, my God, what am I going to do, you know? So the vision here isn't that of no activity or doing nothing or working. The vision here is doing the work that we do without worry, with that childlike feeling that something undergirds who we are in our life. Some of you with really good memories, maybe you can remember, would this have been, I think this probably would have been in a, I don't know, like a high school physics class or, maybe, I don't know, science class or something. Did you ever do that experiment where, you know, you got a little vial of like iron shavings and you poured the iron shavings on a piece of paper? Do you remember this? And you spread it out and then underneath it, remember you put a magnet? Guys, do you remember, some of you remember this? And remember, it would pull all the iron filings together so that the filings ended up taking the shape of the magnet underneath it. That's the logic of the vision here. That like a little child, you can believe that God's kingdom is underneath your life as a foundation. And that if you seek it first, the things of life will line up and take God's shape. But this is an invitation. God will never force it on us. And like all invitations, then it requires a decision to be made. And this is what's happening in the passage about God versus Mammon. Mammon is simply the god of the pursuit of riches, the pursuit of wealth, the pursuit of security outside of Yahweh or Jehovah God or Christ as he was being expressed in Jesus' day. That's what Mammon is. And so Jesus is simply saying this invitation requires a decision. And the psalmist tells us that he had made this decision, he'd found this life in God, where so he says, truly my soul finds rest in God. Truly he's my rock, he is my fortress, my refuge. I will never be shaken. I like the way Peterson gets it in the message. God is a solid rock under my feet. This is a great phrase. Breathing room for my soul. What did I say worry means? Choke, to constrict, to stifle, to strangle. The psalmist says, I found this other way of life. And it's breathing room for my soul. God is my impregnable castle, so I'm set for life. But like the birds of the air, our Isaiah passage, if you look at it, that God is calling a covenant people to work with him. But things can be hard. That's what the passage in Corinthians tells us. When Paul gives us this litany that God has put us apostles on display at the end of the procession, we're like people condemned to die in the arena. You know, we're fools for Christ, we're weak, we're dishonored, we go hungry and thirsty and rags, brutally treated, homeless, working hard with our hands, etc. So that his sort of summation is we become the scum of the earth, the garbage of the world. But the Isaiah passage tells us, when you're working, when you're just sort of doing the activities of life and things go bad, look at the Isaiah passage, for the Lord comforts his people and will have compassion on his afflicted ones. God said this because of the context of Jewish worry. Again, look at your passage in Isaiah, where it says, but Zion said, that is to say, the Jewish people, God's chosen people, said, the Lord has forsaken me, the Lord has forgotten me. And God says, come on, can a mother forget a baby? And then look at the pronouns in this sentence. Though she may forget. That is to say, you may feel like the forces or the places of normal provision in your life are what letting you down. That's sort of the she. This isn't bashing moms. The she here is an analogy of sort of the normal system of provisions for life. You may feel like that's letting you down, but I will never forget you. See, God says, I have engraved you on the palms of my hands. Imagine that. God with tattoos. Jim, Bob, Sally. Now, my son Jonathan was telling me the other day, Jonathan's 26, and he's got tattoos everywhere and on his neck and stuff, and he was telling me that some of them he wants to get changed and that I guess now removing tattoos is becoming easier and easier to do, but I guess it's still very expensive. Well, here's what God's saying. I'm never going to go. Let's laser Bob off. Jane, I'm not really concerned about her. The whole notion here is that you don't have to worry even in hard times. But then that gets back to that decision. And this is a place where I think Eugene is brilliant in the message, you know, he can't serve God and mammon, where he says, adoration of one feeds contempt for the other. And my experience is that is absolutely true. That once you sort of get caught in the addiction, the grip, the strangling, choking power of mammon or money or anything else that one might be trusting in, it actually feeds contempt for God. And following God feeds contempt on the other. And the reason is both God and mammon say, trust me, I'll take care of you, I'll make you secure, I'll make you worry-free, happier, and content. And that's why we have to choose. So Jesus says, here's the choice that I suggest for you. Don't worry about your life, what you eat or drink or your body. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothes? And I got to think a lot of people today would have to stop there and go, I'm not sure. Can I conceive of a life that transcends, you know, body, clothes, food, eat, drink? So when Jesus says things here like, look at the birds of the air, I want you to ask yourself this morning, what kind of life is being commended here? What is it that Jesus means to commend when he says, look at the birds of the air? And I think it's something like this, free and unfettered. I really like this, careless in the care of God. That the care of God gives them a kind of carefree living. I think the passage is something like this. What I'm trying to do here, just hear Jesus saying something like this. What I'm trying to do here is get you to relax, to not be so preoccupied with getting so you can respond to God's giving. People who don't know God and the way he works fusses over these things. But you know both God and how he works. So then steep yourself in God reality, in God initiative, in God provisions. Seek first means something like this. Give your entire attention to what God is doing right now. And don't get worked up about what may or may not happen tomorrow. God will help you deal with whatever hard things come up when the time comes. Now, this doesn't mean we're looking for a life that has no troubles, no problems, no concerns, no fear, no alarming news. That would be boring and it's impossible. What's happening here, what we're looking for, what Jesus is inviting us into, is a relationship between the metal filings of our life as they sit on the real foundation of our life. He's inviting us into a relationship in which we put him and his kingdom beneath that. So that the kingdom, its realm, and its dominion would transcend all the things of our life and give us an actual different kind of life. If Jesus is commending anything here, if there's any sort of thing to be obeyed here, I think the thing to be obeyed is something like this. In which worry doesn't rule. Because it doesn't mean we're never going to be anxious. It doesn't mean we're never going to have a fearful thought. It means something like cultivate an inner life in which worry doesn't rule. Do you think of Jesus as a happy person? I mean, I know there are those passages that we'll study in Lent and around Easter that he was a man of sorrows and, you know, that sort of thing. But fundamentally, day in and day out, what you really picture in your mind's eye, do you picture him as a happy person? And I think the answer is undoubtedly yes. And that what Jesus is talking about here comes out of his direct experience with a God-bathed world. That Jesus himself was experiencing the birds and the flowers. He, out of his direct experience with his Father, had this vigorous sense of God's goodness, which allowed him to live totally in the present, not strangled by these sort of futuristic, vague worries. So when he says things like, look at the birds, he's saying worry is unnecessary. Look at yourself. Worry is unproductive. You can't add anything to your life. Look at the flowers. Worry produces less than faith. And then finally, the last thing I want to draw your attention to this morning in our readings is that Jesus calls his first friends little faiths. Now, this is a very particular word. It seems to be something that Jesus himself invented. Probably a bit of humor, probably a bit of sarcasm or something, kind of sarcastic humor, because it's not in classical Greek. It's nowhere else in New Testament Greek. Nobody actually even knows what this means. So it gets translated in this sort of hyphenated, you little faiths. It probably means something like this. It's probably like the statement a master might make to a group of apprentice electricians. So, you know, picture an electrical truck somewhere, and there's a master, and he's got some apprentices around him, and one of the apprentices does something wrong, and he says, "Ah, you little sparks. Can't even tie two wires together right." It's something like that, where he's saying just kind of, you guys aren't getting it. And what's right at the heart of this little faith thing is specifically a lack of confidence, a lack of trust, a lack of reliance on something that can be underneath their lives. Now, in a moment, I'm going to sit down, and we're going to have a little bit of time to reflect on what I've said, and then we're going to read the creed together. And we do this way because maybe you're here this morning and have never really placed your life on the foundation of Jesus and his kingdom. You may have been all around it, you may have heard about it, you may have danced around it, but if you're honest, you can't say that I really am living a kind of life that is built upon Jesus and his announcement, embodiment, and demonstration of God and his kingdom. But this morning, you can make this really basic decision that God has asked us to make. To respond or not to this invitation, to take our little life, our little kingdom or queendom, and place it into his big, overarching kingdom.